Welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is CJ the DJ and I am your host for this week's Grad Chat. Of course, a show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs as well as CSFARC, so thank you very much to both of them. Now, if your mates miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify and CFRC Podcast. So no excuse not to hear what our awesome students and postdoctoral fellows are doing. Today, though, I'd like to introduce you to Riley Cooper, who has just defended his Master of Applied Science in Electrical and Computer Engineering under the supervision of Dr. Joshua Marshall. Welcome to Grad Chat, Riley, and congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, a lot of work to get there, a lot of late nights, and yeah. I feel like a lot of graduate students know the grind that you got to go through.
I think they do, but I think it was a little unfair that I asked you to come in the very next day after you've been celebrating as well.
I mean, I don't think I was really... Yeah, I was just so tired after my defense yesterday. I just went home and took a nap and, you know, went to bed. But yeah, I just slept in a bit this morning. I think I'll save the festivities for when it's actually submitted and then...
Well, I think that's one of the things people don't quite understand sometimes. You go into a defense and... If you're lucky, they just go, yep, you're done. And But usually there's a few little tweaks that you have to do. So Is it going to be tricky to, not just tricky to do the tweaks, but have the willingness to do it, I guess. I mean, because you kind of think, oh, I'm done, but you're not quite.
Yeah. That was something that I think definitely surprised me. I don't think I've ever heard of anybody coming and finishing their defense without, you know, changes to make or some revisions to do. So I'm hoping I can get mine done by the end of the week. I'm just going to treat this week like a regular work week and just try to get it done by the end of the week and hopefully not have to deal with it again come Monday. So, yeah.
So maybe you could just tell us, what is the process of sitting in a defense? I mean, because it must be quite intimidating.
Yeah, I mean... Well, I'm sure it might differ from department to department, at least in engineering from what I've seen. You go in, you meet your examiners. Typically, you're decided on your committee before you go in. So I knew who my examiners were. I knew both of the professors pretty well, actually.
Okay. That's good.
And then they send you out of the room. They discuss a few things just to give them a chance to discuss without you there. You go in, 20-minute presentation, three rounds. Well, for me, I had two examiners and my professor. So three rounds, 20 minutes each of questionings. If they want the full 20 minutes.
Right.
So that's kind of how it goes. And then there's a second round. Once again, everybody gets another 20 minutes to comment on maybe some questions that someone else asked or so on and so forth. For me, it went pretty well. My professor had told me, you know, I've seen it from a few professors. They tend to ask questions that lead you to give more information that the examiners care about rather than drill you and make you look bad. They're trying to help you look good to everybody. So I ended up not needing too many questions in my second round, which was good. But
that's good.
Changes for everybody. But yeah, then they send you out, they bring you back in, they tell you how you did, and you're done.
It's interesting that you say, you know, you put in questions to sort of help you lead to other questions, which is exactly the same as being on radio, for instance.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I'm going to ask you questions which will hopefully lead to other questions and things because people are interested in what you're doing. So that was a really good practice session for you for today.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, it was. And once again, I planned it for the day after. So maybe I was like thinking, yeah, I'll get some talking in there, some talking in the next day, and I'll be good to go.
So you're in electrical and computer engineering.
Yeah.
And, you know, people say, well, is it computing? Is it engineering? You know, what is it? Is it just on electrics and things? Describe to people, what is electrical and computer engineering?
So electrical and computer engineering, I guess, from my viewpoint, might change for everyone. But, you know, I can see at different universities, electrical and computer engineering might be different degrees, but there's a lot of overlap. A lot of it ends up being for computer. Obviously, it's knowing about the inner workings of computing devices that you know, how to code them, how to do proper data structures, kind of delving more into what computer science does a little bit and algorithms and things of the sort. Electrical engineering has a pretty wide range, in my opinion. There's anything from telecommunications and down to photonic transfer of light in wires and other spaces. Not my field. I don't know everything about it. But to designing circuit boards, dealing with power distribution, or I guess more similar to what I do, I kind of work in the control space. So a bit more of the mathy area of electrical and control engineering. I mean, it's all pretty mathy, but dealing with, I guess, measuring values and making sure that Everything is behaving as you want. Kind of like if you think of your thermostat, you set it to a value, you want it to change temperature kind of within it. I work at that idea of algorithm to a much larger degree.
Okay. So what made you interested in this area in the first place? Was it, you know, I know kids growing up these days, they're so much more comfortable with computers and all the little gadgets, technology in general. What made you want to get into this sort of area?
I think for me, well, out of high school, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. So I just applied for engineering and then went into engineering here at Queen's. And then when I got the choice in second year, I ended up choosing the applied math and engineering program.
Okay.
And so then through there, I got to build up kind of my basis in math as just somebody who enjoyed math in high school and really jump off and go from there. And a lot of the courses in that degree specifically focus on control and higher levels of that and more complicated versions. And from there, when I looked at either starting work at the beginning of COVID, or I think my fourth year was the first big year of COVID for going to school, and then either doing work after that or doing a graduate degree, research had always interested me. I didn't really want to start a job remotely. That didn't seem as intriguing to me. So going to graduate studies and, you know, robotics and that kind of stuff, which had controls, was really interesting to me, especially since robotics, I think, is a good overlap of you need some mechanical knowledge of how everything moves, some computer knowledge of how to code it, and some electrical knowledge of doing all the sensors and lights and stuff. So a big overlap of a lot of things I didn't know a lot about, but I wanted to learn. So I applied, I got in with Professor Marshall, and then I just kind of leaned into the control side because that's what I was used to.
Okay, so I guess we should lean into exactly what you're doing here, or what you've just completed.
Yeah.
So your research topic is data-driven non-linear model predictive control for an autonomous surface vessel. You people in engineering love long titles, I can tell you. I had another beauty the other day, so this is a good one too.
Was that Graziella, if you don't remember?
Yes, it was.
Yes, she's a friend and colleague of mine.
In fact, we've had a few of your colleagues here, and we were just talking before we started this interview with Frank and Spot the Dog and all those sorts of things. So it's the same sort of area. So give us a bit of an overview. What were you trying to do with this predictive control for an autonomous surface vessel?
Sure, yeah. I guess the easiest place to start to get rid of some of those big words is an autonomous surface vessel or an uncrewed surface vessel is just a fancy word for a boat. So I work with a robotic boat. We throw it into Lake Ontario every once in a while, and it drives on its own. We can set up paths, and it'll follow the paths, or we can drive it with a PS4 controller if we want, or do a lot of fun things with it. And when I started working with the boat and thinking about controls, which for a robot, a lot of the controls that we focus on in Joshua Marshall's lab is how to get it to move. So how do we control it to move as we wish, or, you know, dealing with disturbances in a better way, which is kind of what I do. Because when you think about a boat trying to drive a straight line on the water, well, it's dealing with the wind, it's dealing with the waves, it's dealing with the current, all of which could be at different forces or amount of disturbance and in different directions. So it's a lot of things to incorporate and deal with when you're trying to get it to just drive a straight line even, or take a turn especially. So my research kind of focused on how can we look at how we're telling the boat to move or its control strategy and incorporate kind of what the disturbances are doing in that moment. So what are the waves doing? How are the wind and the waves and the current affecting me at any given time? And so a lot of people, and especially a lot of my colleagues at Ingenuity Labs, work on machine learning and AI and things of the sort. So we decided to take a data-driven approach, which just means let's gather a bunch of data to try to understand what's going on. So my project, you start the boat, it will go gather a bunch of data of what's happening that day, what the wind and the waves and the current are like in your area and that are affecting you in that moment. Then using that data, I do a little bit of learning and I make kind of a model of what I think is going on. So it's just some math equations that basically describe, oh yeah, I think this is how your entire system, the boat and the wind and the waves and the current, this is a description, approximate description with math of what's going on. And then my controller, or basically my code on the boat, can use that model of what it thinks is going on to make a better decision about how much force it needs to use to take a turn, or how quickly it needs, or how much force descended the motors to go in a straight line.
So you're asking it to learn because, I mean, the data you're collecting is data at a certain moment in time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it's not going to necessarily be the same tomorrow or the day after after that. So you're putting in these parameters.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, what are you saying? If the current comes from this direction, this force,
mm-hmm.
you need to correct like this.
Yeah. So it's not necessarily as if else as that in the sense of like,
right.
oh, if the current's like this, do this instead. But I just try to give the boat a general understanding of what's going on. Of like, without getting too much into the learning and complicating it mm-hmm. too much. Yeah, I just make a mathematical representation of this is what's kind of going on and how your position's being affected, how where your facing's being affected by everything going on in the data that we just gathered. And then based on that mathematical description, I have a lot of algorithms set up in the controller to determine, okay, this is the best, if I'm going forward, if I'm trying to take a turn at this location, based on what I think I know of my understanding of the environment right now, I think
right.
the best idea is to take a turn with this much force on the motors.
So this boat that mm-hmm. you're working with,
mm-hmm.
what size is it? Is it a normal size boat or is it a little model boat?
It's like in between. So it's not quite big enough. You could maybe fit one person on it, but
oh, really?
I wouldn't suggest
okay, it's
that.
It's bigger than I thought.
Yeah,
okay.
It's about 2 meters by 1.8. by 0.9 meters roughly.
Okay.
So yeah, 2 by 2 by 1 approximate. Yeah, so we have a lot of sensors on board. We have some computers on board, a lot of different things that I guess we need to do what we do.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not the only person working on it. There's a few other colleagues of mine who maybe you'll have interviews with down the line who also work on the boat. And yeah.
So forgive me, I could be wrong here.
Mm-hmm.
Big ships,
mm-hmm.
cruise liners,
yep.
all these sorts of things. They have all sorts of gadgets in their captain's room, whatever the top part
yeah,
is called.
Yeah, sure.
What's the difference between what they're doing and what you're doing? Because they have sensors to say different mm-hmm. things, don't they?
Yeah, yeah. So I am working on strategies that maybe you could apply to a big boat, but the focus, I think, is on smaller vessels that can serve different applications. So, for example, I couldn't take a cruise liner down the Cataraqui River.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of applications for, say, scientists who are interested in monitoring environments or people who want to survey the bottom of the body of water that you're looking at or for environmental testing and looking at different populations of algae in different areas of the water or for having a swarm of smaller vehicles try to help in identifying cleaning up oil spills. There's a lot of
which is Graciela stuff.
Yeah, yeah, a little bit there. So still a lot of applications outside of just a big cruise liner. I think what I do could be applied, but I think the big benefit of my particular strategy is that it's a little less intensive. So where on a big boat, you can have as big of a computer as you want to do as many calculations if you wanted to make it really smart.
Right.
With a smaller boat, you have to think about how much power you have to give, you know, how big of a computer you can fit on it. Just a lot of different factors, I guess.
So it's interesting you say that about, you know, the size of the computer, mm-hmm. for instance. I mean, yeah. everything is getting smaller and smaller these days.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
surely with that, the size wouldn't make so much of a difference for a smaller vessel.
That yeah, very true when it comes to the computer. But another very important thing is the stronger the computer, oftentimes the more power that you need to run it. And batteries, while still getting smaller, are still pretty big. It's a problem that my friends who work with drones face a lot because you can't really put a big honking battery on something and expect it to fly. Our
right.
boat's a little better. We can run for like 24 hours on some like really heavy batteries, but still a problem in our industry as well.
So what is there a difference between what you're trying to do on water as opposed to the electric cars and autonomous cars on the road today? Because they scare the bejesus out of me thinking someone's sitting there not paying attention to the road.
Yeah, I guess in the autonomous sense, it's pretty much the same. No one's at the helm of this boat. We're connected remotely. It's not fully autonomous
okay.
in the sense of like we have an e-stop that we can hit from afar. But yeah, it's pretty similar. And kind of the strategy that I've been working on could be used in that kind of area as well. I just chose, I guess, boats as a topic because we had a new boat that we got and do some fun test days down by the beach.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
So, I mean, I know you gave a couple of examples that you could use this would be great on smaller boats because you can go up smaller tributaries and things where big boats can't, et cetera, to get people to a certain place, for instance, or get a vehicle to a place to do some data collection for other things. What else would you want, would potentially this could be used for? Is it, as you said, it, you know, we look at postal services and they're talking about drones. You talked about drones before.
Yeah.
Drones coming and delivering whatever gadget or whatever item you've bought off online shopping these days. So we'll, instead we're going to have all these drones. Is there something similar you want, you could potentially do with this if you could make a vessel fully autonomous to go up and down, keeping cars off the road, maybe freeing up the railways, etc. Let's start using some of the waterways that we have.
Yeah. That, I mean, I think that's kind of the goal, right? Like, I feel like a lot of there's international shipping, which is huge.
Yes.
So there's really big vessels.
Which can be dangerous.
But also, I mean, I haven't traveled much, but from what I hear, there's a lot of cities kind of over in Europe that use their waterways pretty well.
They do, yeah.
So it'd be really cool if here in, you know, Canada, we can do something similar. I mean, part of the year, maybe not, it's frozen over, but for some parts of the year, it'd be great.
Yeah.
Like, I'm from Newfoundland originally, so, you know, big tie to the water and the oceans and boating industry there. And,
which would be a great place to test it, because the seas there are pretty rough.
Yeah. It's there's actually a lot of research in similar projects. I ended up coming off of the island of Queens to do something else just to get away for a bit, and somehow found myself back at exactly what they're doing at the island, on the island, to somewhat.
Right.
So, yeah, can't escape everything.
So what have you learned so far? I mean, a Master of Applied Science is only a couple of years, and clearly this is a big project because, like you said, you're just one part of it. What have you guys found so far with trying to understand the collect the variables and then find some sort of algorithm to put back in so that they next time they see that variable, they know what to do?
So in general senses, another project, which I might not get too far into because my colleague mentioned he was interested in doing one of these, but I guess a teaser for maybe some of your viewers. A colleague of mine, Thomas Sears, who's a PhD student, is working on mapping waves. So kind of understanding what they're doing for like erosion purposes.
That makes sense.
And a lot of people kind of around Queens are working on that. But as far as what I'm doing specifically, I'm not necessarily collecting data to bring back to someone or show them. The data I collect at the start of the day is just saying, hey, here's what you're doing. This is what's on the go. Try to track the path better. The end goal of my project is, can the boat follow the path better with my strategy than other strategies? Because mine takes these disturbances into account at the start of the day.
What happens if something new happens?
I mean, you can't account for everything, but the goal is that hopefully, say there's a huge gust of wind or a giant boat comes by in the harbor and, you know, gives a big wave that you're not ready for. You know, you can't control everything, but my goal was, can I improve over other strategies? So hopefully, because I actually consider the waves, most of the strategies that, or I won't say most, but a lot of the strategies that exist don't consider the disturbances. They're just too complicated.
Oh.
You know, like, it's kind of hard to identify what waves are doing.
Well, I thought that'd be pretty obvious to consider waves.
You'd think.
On water.
Yeah, I mean, it seems pretty obvious when you think about it, but when you get down to the nitty gritty, there's a lot involved in trying to predict or understand or map the waves, exactly why my colleague is kind of working on it.
Right.
And the current as well, or the wind, you need maybe specific sensors to do so. And if you don't have those, what do you do? So my project was saying, okay, well, let's, you know, this is a smaller boat. We don't have room for every kind of sensor in the world. Let's try to get a good strategy that'll work for this kind of vessel. Mm-hmm. And then if people were looking to downsize even further, the sensors that I used weren't terribly big, so they could use it on a smaller vessel and still get better performance with these restrictions. I guess if you're thinking about, well, yeah, you could put more stuff on it. You could get a bigger boat. I guess I was trying to restrict myself purposefully and see how good of an improvement I could do.
Well, have a smaller model that then hopefully you can build on from there.
Yeah.
These sensors that you've been talking about, did you make those or were they given to you and that you just go into the shop and go, I want a sensor that can pick up this and a sensor that can pick up that? And is it like that or is it a lot harder than that?
So I guess on your comment of what's electrical and computer engineering at the start, it would probably be someone else in the same field who would have built it or designed it.
Right.
But for my purposes, I focus as like a control person on, okay, now that I have the data, what algorithms do I run to make my whole system do what I want it to do?
Right.
You know, if you think about something in your house, I use the thermostat as an example.
Yes.
I would maybe design the algorithm that gets the heaters to turn on and then raise the temperature of the house. But I wouldn't design the heaters. I wouldn't design the temperature sensor itself. Right. I wouldn't design your thermostat control panel. I would be the person designing that algorithm of, oh, we sense this temperature. Now let's automatically turn the heaters on to get it to go hotter. So in the same way, it's, oh, if I'm trying to follow a straight line path, I sense that I'm off it. Let me give the motor commands to go back onto the line.
To go back onto it. Yeah. And it really does show how interdisciplinary and collaborative these sorts of projects are, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm,
like you said, you're looking at the algorithm type things, not necessarily this creating the sensor in the first place. How do you make sure that actually works? Because collaborations can be great if everyone's on the same page.
Mm-hmm.
They can be an absolute disaster if one area fails in their task.
Yeah, exactly. As a researcher, as somebody on a very small team, I'd say everybody kind of learns a bit of everything. So you have a bit of an understanding. So I might not, like, for example, the particular sensor that I use the most is called inertial measurement unit, or IMU. So it detects your rotation in space, or how your vehicle's rotated. I'm not the one who's the best at working with that. A colleague of mine is very good at interfacing with it and making sure that we can get the data that we need.
Right.
I'm just the one who knows what to do with that data. So it's a lot of back and forth of teamwork, communication, like it's very important in engineering. And then trying to understand a little bit of what your colleagues do, at least at the surface level, so you can know what questions to ask and how to phrase them properly.
And I think that's the most important thing, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Are we asking the right question?
Yeah, yeah. It's a big topic they bring up early in engineering is no matter who you're talking to, you need to understand, okay, what are they asking you to get? But what do they really want you
to
build or to design? Or what's the real requirement? If they want something to be better, what are they actually asking for?
Yeah, so it's not just the same. We want to build an autonomous vessel.
Mm-hmm.
It is, well, my questions would be, well, why do we want to build it?
Mm-hmm.
In what capacity?
Yeah.
And who do we need to make it work?
Exactly. So if you were to kind of go that route for my project, you might get like, okay, well, your why might be, okay, well, we want something that can go out and explore all the different lakes and areas in Algonquin and keep an eye on the environmental status.
Right.
Okay, but to do that, you need someone to go out and do it the whole time, and that takes a lot of effort and it takes a lot of time. They can't go out at night. They're very restricted. What's a robotic way that we could do that? Okay, well, you need a robot to go do it. Okay,
right.
Well, how do we make the robot look at the areas we want to look, and how do we know it's not going to hit the shore or, you know, it's actually going to do what we want it to do? And that's where you get into kind of what I'm doing of, let's make the robot just even be able to follow a path is a small part of a lot of larger solutions.
How long does it take you to come up with what you want to accomplish in the short time that you have or you had?
Mm-hmm,
because you could have gone, and like you said, you could have gone into all sorts of things. You could have gone really big, which wouldn't be very good in a 2-year project.
Mm-hmm.
But you made a distinctive thing of saying, I'm only going to look at how can we keep them on a straight path.
Yeah.
But what made you come to that?
A lot of the decision-making of what project you're going on. For some students, they come in and their professor might have a project in mind.
Right.
For me, that wasn't the case. I had to do a lot of back and forth with my professor. And, you know, we had different ideas at the start. At one point, we thought about tracking fish with the boat. At one
All
point,
right.
we thought about... before we were even on boats, I looked at how do we deal with slip with cars and things like that. So it was kind of a lot of back and forth and looking at my professor's research interests along with what I wanted to look into and eventually coming to an agreement of, okay, I think this is a good path of control on boats.
Right.
And then what's the problem we're tackling? What's our unique thing that we're doing? And that's my like, okay, well, let's try to incorporate the disturbances in a different way. So, yeah.
Did you succeed?
Yeah, I actually did. So one of my
experiments work.
Yeah, I was very happy that the first things one of my examiners said was, it was really good to see somebody do a project with field work that actually worked for once, because that doesn't always happen.
No, it doesn't. So that's fantastic. That's a big plus already, isn't it, for you?
Yeah, yeah. So it did work. I built a couple controllers and compared them, and I saw that as I just did one that didn't have any idea of what the waves or disturbances were doing. It did pretty well. Mm-hmm. Did follow the path well overall, but you could see that it got a lot better, especially on, like, there were a few turns where a lot of wind hitting the vehicle during my test loop that I was doing. And when I started incorporating those disturbances, you could see it take the turn a lot better, a lot closer. It didn't have to, like, recover back to the path as much. So, yeah.
That's good. Yeah. So what's next?
What's next? I think I'm going to try to pursue a job in industry for the moment, just to pay off some student debt and get a good financial
sometimes
basis.
Sometimes it's good to have a break from the research.
Yeah, I think I'd like to return, though. I think very much enjoyed my time with research. Could pursue maybe a position in academia, that might be interesting. I don't really know what the future holds for me, but I definitely know a lot of my colleagues that I see doing the work I'm most interested in are the ones who have gone to industry, been out there, in academia the whole time. They've been out in the real world seeing what people in their positions are doing in different companies and things like that. And then they've returned to academia having learned of what problems they're really interested out there.
And I think that's an important thing to bring up, because a lot of people think, oh, they've got to keep going. And sometimes you do need to go back out into the real world.
Yeah, gain some perspective.
And see what's going on. And, mm-hmm. and like you said, you know, what are people finding out there? Are there new things that if I just stayed inside academia, I would never hear about?
Mm-hmm.
And particularly in engineering, you've got to keep on top of what's going on out there.
Yeah, being somebody in robotics, there's so many problems out there that I mm-hmm. think robotics could be really helpful with, but nobody's doing them because either the people doing robotics don't know about these problems or they're just not as flashy as like autonomous driving and things like that. So you kind of got to get out there to really understand what are the problems that people are facing that need solutions rather than just staying in your office in academia and saying, if I do this much better on this much strategy, then I'll get this paper or whatever. I think it's more important that rather than try to hunt down papers that you could do better at, just try to find problems that people need solved.
What needs solving today? I mean, the mm-hmm. same happens in the medical field. We have a lot of people who are practitioners, but they come back because they've seen something that's not working right. So how mm-hmm. can we do it better? So they mm-hmm. come back and study it mm-hmm. to find new solutions and things.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really good. So that's going to keep you busy too. And it's always good to try and pay off your student loans.
Mm-hmm. very much. So,
no, it's always good to have a break. Gives your mind a bit of a break as well.
Yeah, for sure.
So lastly, you enjoy rock climbing and juggling. Now, you could say with your work it's juggling things anyway, in a different way, but why rock climbing and juggling?
Put those down. Juggling's kind of a new thing. It's something that my friend's the president of the juggling club here.
Oh, we've got a juggling club?
Yeah, yeah.
Club don't we have here at Queen's?
Yeah, see us juggling in Mitchell, I think, one night a week. I think it's Wednesdays lately. Right. But juggling I kind of got into after rock climbing. A lot of people in Kingston, especially engineers, for whatever reason, enjoy rock climbing. Yes. I think it's the way my friends and I describe it. It's a lot of just quick problem solving that has some pretty immediate reward.
Because
once you get
it,
you're like, oh, yes, I got it. Because it's not just you can be strong and do it. There's a lot of technique to it, especially mm-hmm. when you get to some harder stuff and you have to figure out, and you can be there with your friends and be like, oh, but what if we tried this? What if we moved our hand in this way or tried switching this up or jumping here or something like that? So it's a lot of quick problem solving. And when you figure out even just one part of a full climb, you're like, that felt great. That was awesome. I think I can do that. So a lot of that problem solving aspect. And then juggling is kind of similar in a way where you start on a new trick or a new thing that you want to do. And then you keep working on it. I've been finding it very good as a mental break, as we were talking about, a break for the mind, because it's very muscle memory intensive. So it's something that I found myself when I was writing my thesis, I was doing like 14-hour days to get that out last month. So when I was very just all in my head, I'd go and just throw a few balls around and then I'd let my brain sit while my hands were busy. I've had a rough shoulder with a bit of an injury for the past few years, and it's been pretty good for rehab. So,
well, that's good.
Yeah.
See, all these things are really, really important as you're going through, because mm-hmm. you're right. You can't sit at a desk or wherever it is and just use your brain the whole time. Your brain does need a break.
Yeah.
And just sleeping sometimes isn't good enough, because sometimes it's hard to switch off when you're sleeping
while
you're trying to sleep. Mm-hmm. So having a different focus is quite the way to go. And so, Riley, I do want to thank you so much for coming
on
the show,
thank you,
particularly after your defense. I know you're tired, but one more week.
Yeah, that's it. One
and
more
then
week,
you
yeah.
can go out and celebrate properly with your mates. And yeah. And we look forward to seeing you at Convocation then, hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah, yeah. My mum's reminded me a few times to apply.
Oh, is that right?
I got to remember to do that, yeah.
Mums have to do that, right? Yeah. It's part of their DNA. Mm-hmm. So thank you again for coming on. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat sadly comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download the show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcast. Just type in a Grad Chat. Until next week, this is CJ the DJ signing off with a big hooray.
Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University, situated on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of the Faculty of Engineering and Applied Science.